Hello and welcome to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. I'm Richard Moore and I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Richard.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard. Hello, Daniel.
And Lionel, we're back in the South Bank Centre. There was some beautiful carol singing going on a minute ago. That might form a sort of background to parts of the podcast.
Well, it's, 12 days till Christmas, so a bit of carol singing. That's get us all in the festive mood.
My jumper's very festive, isn't it?
It is.
Primark, is it?
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Okay, first of all, I'd like to thank our newest listener, Mr. Lance Armstrong in Austin, Texas, who listened to last week's podcast with David Walsh and was kind enough to tweet about it to his 4 million or something followers. Right, we're going to talk about something completely different this week. We've got a couple of interviews to play. We've got the inimitable Oleg Tinkoff and the equally inimitable Mark Cavendish. So, part one, but let's talk about Tinkoff. We didn't talk about this last week because we had David Walsh on, but Daniel, you and I attended the very strange Tinkoff press conference in London at the Google headquarters, which the announcement of that location led to much feverish speculation that Google were going to sponsor a cycling team. I suspect if Google had been sponsoring the team, the press conference would have been a slightly slicker than it was, but basically, the press conference was to announce that Tinkoff was taking over Bjarne Riis's team. So it will, from next year, be Tinkoff-Saxo with Alberto Contador as leader. And if Contador's body language in that press conference was anything to go by, that's not going to be a very happy marriage, I don't think.
No, I mean, it's been well documented that it wasn't a great relationship last year between Tinkoff and Contador. Riis is still on board. A lot of the Danish press were speculating before this press conference what would Riis's role be under this new arrangement with Tinkoff taking over the team. Riis officially is going to be there for at least 3 years as a team manager. I mean, I got the impression, Rich, I don't know about you, but he's really just keeping that seat warm. I think he fears the worst from the investigation currently going on in Denmark, and certainly the Danish press fears the worst, and they can easily foresee him being removed from that position, removed from professional cycling, at least for a period of a couple of years, as a result of that investigation, which obviously throws the whatever plans Tinkoff and Contador have into some doubt.
Keeping him on in that role as a manager on a apparently very generous salary allows Bjarne Riis to salvage some dignity, I think, from the situation. And, you know, if the worst comes to worst and he is suspended or has to serve some kind of ban, that provides Tinkoff with a reason to get rid of him as well, or to at least put him on leave. There was a strange atmosphere to the press conference. We were kind of squeezed into a little room, and there was much kind of fake joviality from Tinkoff.
There always is from Tinkoff, isn't
there? Yeah, and Contador wasn't really playing ball in that regard. But Riis, what interests me about this arrangement is that Riis is notoriously a bit of a control freak when it comes to his team in particular, and what we hear about him is that, you know, he has won great praise over the years. He's run quite an innovative team. He's praised for his sort of openness to different experts, whether it be people from the army to lead off-season training camps and so on. But what you hear is that he, when he brings experts in, he will often seek their advice and then overrule them, that he won't necessarily defer to their knowledge in that particular area. He often has the final word.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was very hands-on up until roughly when Carlos Sastre won the Tour in 2008. And about the time he started needing to look for sponsors, he was spending less and less time at races, more and more time on the golf course, I think, much like one of our new listeners, Lance Armstrong, I was told. And I think that's continued over the last 3 or 4 years. And I just get the impression that, regardless of the Danish anti-doping investigation, I just wonder what is his great source of motivation now. It feels as though he's come to the end of sort of two separate cycles in his time as a team manager, one of which was forming this, you know, team with an enviable reputation, CSC, very successful. Then Contador came along and he made it his business to win the Tour again with Alberto Contador. Hasn't succeeded yet. But it almost seems to me as though the wind has been taken out of his sails a little bit. There is a feeling in Denmark that he thinks he didn't get enough credit for Sastre's win in 2008, partly because it was contentious. Sastre and Rhys sort of fell out towards the end of that tour, and Rhys is now determined to win the tour.
There is a feeling of desperation about it as well, because if memory serves me correctly, it was only a few weeks ago they had a press conference in Madrid to announce that the future of the team was secure, Saxo Bank were remaining as title sponsor, Tinkoff wasn't going to be involved, and then everything changed in the last few weeks. It's very, very, very strange. Nobody really commented on that.
No, and I understand that there were various falling outs last year between Rhys and Tinkoff. I mean, I remember when Tinkoff first came on board, and I put it to him that they were very, very different characters, him and Rhys. And he said, "Ah, my wife is just like Bjarne. She's Estonian. We've been together 25 years. She doesn't talk much. I do all the talking, so it will work just fine." And it seemed to work okay for a few months, but less so, I was told, last year, certainly at the tour.
Lionel, why did you make a sort of zipping your mouth a gesture earlier on there? The one that our new listener made once to Filippo Simeone.
Yeah. Just the idea of Bjarne Rhys bringing in outside experts to consult us on various things. I thought we were going to have to get the lawyers involved there.
Perhaps not,
I don't know.
Just
on this, I hope that that Rhys and Tinkoff will have a different relationship to the one that Tinkoff has with his wife. But it strikes me that this is fire and ice as in terms of their characters. Tinkoff is probably one of the more entertaining in a sort of theatrical, almost circus style way on Twitter, and Rhys is famously, you know, silent, the strong, silent type. I mean, sometimes you can talk to him outside the team bus and get almost nothing back from him.
It's like Darth Vader, isn't it?
It is like Darth Vader. Yeah, the way this has all come about, it's a bit like a cross between a sort of management buyout, in which the previous director is kept on in a sort of consultancy capacity, or a director of football being imposed above a manager. And I just from the little I know about how Rhys works, I can't see how he's going to tolerate that level of kind of public meddling that Tinkoff is inevitably going to bring. He's not going to withhold his feelings and thoughts from the public domain if things don't go well.
Well, he touches on that in the interview that we're going to play with him very soon, Oleg. I spoke to Stephen Roach actually last week, whose son Nicholas was also there, and who rides for Tinkoff Saxo, as it will now be known. And he said that Tinkoff is a big fan of Nicholas's, so he's okay. But he admitted that the things between Contador and Tinkoff don't look good. And, you know, they appeared in the press conference last week where Tinkoff kind of jokingly tried to climb onto Contador's shoulders. Mm-hmm. And Contador just wasn't... He looked miserable throughout. He had his arms folded. The body language was not very encouraging. Lionel and Daniel both have their arms folded, actually, as I speak. It's not very encouraging body language.
Sorry.
Contador didn't look happy at all. I mean, you know, there's no two ways about it. He looked miserable. And is he going to... Is that going to last? It will last, I suppose, next year. He's under contract till the end of 2014, isn't he? Then talk of him maybe hooking up with Alonso in this new Spanish team.
He has looked very much on the slide, hasn't he, over the last year. Certainly last year, there was a discernible deterioration in his acceleration.
Well, and last year was really the first year we've seen that. The only year we've seen that before was 2011, when he was coming there straight from the Giro, which he had won in very convincing fashion. So, you know, he was clearly not at his best. But this is the first time we've ever seen him in a Grand Tour for which he has supposedly prepared perfectly, not perform as you know, as he can, because he won the Vuelta when he came back from his ban as well.
He is getting towards what should be his sell-by date. I mean, he's had...
Well, Daniel, I mean, he's only 30. He's only just turned 31, so he was 30 this year. He turned 31 last week, if memory serves me correctly. So,
yeah, but, you know, Bradley Wiggins should be, won the tour at 32. Yeah. Cadel Evans, I think, 32, 33. Yeah, so was he older, Evans, actually? But,
he's got a lot of miles on the clock, hasn't he, Contador, I suppose, you could say.
Doing two Grand Tours a year for every season for the last number, except when he was banned. You're right. I mean, it's a different kind of toll on a rider, isn't it? Particularly, as you say, his acceleration is his, you know, his unique selling point, if you like. And that's kind of going to be the first thing to go, isn't it? That top end speed.
Yeah, and we've seen last 2 years, we've seen domination of Sky, certainly in the Tour de France, but to a certain extent in the Grand Tours in general. And you know, a lot of that has come about because of some of the work they put in terms of equipment, in terms of training, etc. And Contador has not been on teams that have been noted for the amount they've invested besides, you know, the personnel. And I'm not sure how much Tinkoff has got to actually invest in.
Well, he's got a lot, hasn't he? And we should probably hear from Tinkoff now. This was a little huddle after the main press conference. So there were a few journalists there, and you'll hear questions from some of them, including Daniel, who chipped in with a couple. It's an entertaining little interview, this, but difficult to know how seriously to take some of his answers. I don't know, some of them are clearly meant in jest. And we'll hear now from Oleg Tinkoff.
Will you be aggressive on the market?
Not really. I'm a rational businessman. Not to forget, I'm not oligarch. There are two different Russians. Russians that made money on the oil and gas and the political connection. And there are some Russians, there are a few of them, who made their money themselves. And I'm the second generation, or if you wish, new generation of Russian businessmen. And I'm efficient, I'm not stupid. Yes, it's my passion, and it's my toy. And I would like to spend some money to buy some talents and riders, but it's nothing crazy. I'm just not going to buy everybody. I pay ridiculous prices, no way.
You said that you don't think there's any doping in cycling today. Why do you think
think that's my opinion. It's like IMHO, yeah? In my humble opinion, I cannot guarantee you. It usually is happening in the small teams and the juniors level when they still think it's like enhanced, you know, perform drug, give them something. But as of me and the serious peloton, I never hear something about that. There is always suspicious and so on, but I don't believe right now there is a doping in the peloton. That's my idea. I might be naive.
You said about the investigation from the Anti-Doping Association in Denmark that you would have to take action on it if something happens. I mean, then you've already considered.
We have to deal with it. If there is a real sort of document, then we have to respect the official documents. We have to respect the decision of the jury, whatever. Once there is rumors, speculations, or like guesses, I cannot. Because there are some sponsors, and there's the difference being owner of the team and pay the bills, or being the sponsor. Sponsor, it's run by marketing managers, marketing directors, and they want to cover their ass. Once they hear something, they're afraid, so it's going to be a big problem for them. They're not going to get their bonus, so or the boss will fire them for the bad involvement with this, so they drop. It's very hypocritical. For me, there should be a matter of fact. If there is a decision of the anti-doping committee or whatever, or license committee or court, then we have to deal with it. And then, of course, we don't have Bjarne, unfortunately. But before that, I don't care what they're talking about. They're all talking.
But I guess you
don't forget that all of the guys, they want to sell the books. All of those writers who is writing now, they want to sell the books. They want you, journalists, to write about that. And the stupid people to go and buy those books. That's it. They're making money, and you're helping them to make money.
Did you read Tyler Hamilton's book, Oleg?
Why would I read such a shit?
You mentioned him.
I mentioned in many, many books, my friend, okay? I'm quite famous, so I don't even bother to read them, you know. I have wrote myself two books, so what? One is translated in English, and I never read. I don't read a lot, but when I have a time, I read something proper, but not this sort of bullshit.
But you said that the doping was tolerated on Tinkoff credit
system. That's bullshit. That's what he said. That's what he said. He wants to sell the book. I met him like you one time in my life, just for 5 days, that I never seen him after.
But you said that you have to wait for the facts, for the documents. Then I guess you've already thought about that Bjarne Riis could get a ban.
Zero tolerance to the doping. Fact is that I have been owning team for 3 years, okay? Tinkoff restaurant, 1 year. Tinkoff credit system, 2 years. And I have been sponsoring for 2 years Saxa Tinkoff. 5 years when I was involved with the team. Zero doping cases, okay? Zero doping cases. So there is no tolerance. Never ever my rider, whether I am sponsor or owner, been involved. Basta. Finish.
Oleg, you talked about your conversations with Alberto. It didn't sound like at the end of last year you expected him to be able to win the Tour de France again. Have you changed your opinion? Do you think he can now?
I still believe that Alberto is probably one of the few, if not the only one, who can beat Froome. Froome is the strongest rider right now, I have to admit that, unfortunately for me. But I think Alberto is the one who can challenge him.
You said that you won't interfere in any of the sporting, but
that's true, yeah.
You have been kind of active on your Twitter account saying do this or do that or buy this and buy that.
But
I would do. Will you stop with that in the future?
Everyone has opinion, right? So why don't I share my opinion? I think sometimes journalists treat my Twitter too seriously. It's not my official way of communication. My Twitter account, if you wish, it's my sort of alter ego. I'm just laughing there, making fun. I believe that internet is for porn and Twitter for fun.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freed.
So that was our friend Oleg Tinkoff, Daniel. Difficult to know what to make of him. Is he just playing a part? Is he to be taken seriously?
Well, I wouldn't take what he says about doping, you know, the way, the kind invitation
to stop asking questions
about doping. I wouldn't take that too seriously. I don't think, as a team owner nowadays, he said that doping is over as far as he's concerned. I don't think that there are team owners necessarily controlling doping programs of whole teams now. I think we can be fairly confident of that. And but he is entertaining. I was talking to a good old friend of yours, Rich, the other day, Bob Stapleton.
Oh, Bob Stapleton.
Just to explain, this is Bob Stapleton, the old boss of the HTC Columbia team.
Yeah. Who bowed out the sport in 2011.
And he seemed to be... Bob Stapleton seems to be quite impressed with Tinkoff. I mean, for all his bravado, for all his bluster, he was at pains to stress the other day, a self-made man, unlike the other billionaires that have come into the sport. I think that at least he's passionate about the sport, would be slightly concerned about what Jörg Jatsch has said about him in the past, Tyler Hamilton has said about him in the previous incarnation of his team Tinkoff.
I hope that singing is coming through on the podcast.
It's
rather nice. And it's a sort of high wire act, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you want colourful people in cycling. He does sometimes cross the line into sort of inappropriateness, I think, in some of his tweets.
Yeah, and he's boasted to a certain extent about the riders that he brought into that first team Tinkoff Credit Systems, the Russians Ignatiev, a guy called Ivan Rovny, who he's actually taken now again on Saxo Tinkoff. These guys were evidence of some great talent factory that he had in place. Actually, the majority of Russian riders that came through...
He also mentioned Kirienka, didn't he?
Kirienka. The majority of riders that came through that team, Russian riders, have pretty much disappeared over the last few years. And it's actually curious that in spite of having two fairly high-profile teams in the last few years, Katusha and Tinkoff, the Russians have really not made all that much progress, have they? Katusha have been very reliant over the last few years on Joaquin Rodriguez.
It's true.
This is the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Freed.
Let's move on, because we've got an interview coming up with Mark Cavendish, which was conducted around the publication of his new book, At Speed, which, Daniel, I think you've read that, haven't you?
Yeah, I have now.
Mark, looking ahead to next year, he's got a big year next year, hasn't he? Big test. Is this the biggest test of his career, what he does next year?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's going to have to reinvent himself to a certain extent. I think he's already done that once or twice in his career. I think he'll have a much stronger team next year. He'll have Renshaw, Pataki. It'll be interesting to see how the different pieces of that jigsaw fit together. There's been, I think his team are slightly aggrieved at a few of the things he said in his book. Over the last few weeks, there have been discussions with Patrick Lefebvre, the team manager, about comments Mark made about Wilfred Peters, the director sportif. And Mark didn't feel that Peters had a lot of confidence in him. Peters publicly sort of tried to diffuse what could have turned into a public row, but I think behind the scenes there have been not cr- crisis talks, but there have been some fairly frank discussions about the way the team needs to go forward this year.
Interesting, because also Lefebvre recently was fairly outspoken in saying that Mark, you know, is contracted to them, and while he is, he won't be riding the track, you know, which kind of torpedoes or certainly damages potentially his ambitions or ideas to ride at the Rio Olympics.
Yeah, I think increasingly Mark is looking at that, the kind of commitment it would take, and the
what's interesting is that Mark has, because of the type of personality and character he is, people have indulged him to some extent. And where people don't indulge him, Bob Stapleton sort of did and didn't, he can fall out with them quite quickly.
Oh, absolutely. He's very strong-minded. I mean, we know that. We all know that. There was a feeling for a long time that he was being indulged too much at HTC Columbia. This is something that Dave Brailsford used to say. And I'm not sure that's true. I mean, certainly...
Well, he needs to be indulged to some extent. The whole problem with Sky was that he wasn't indulged enough, perhaps.
Yeah, and actually, I think when people... He works quite well with straight shooters. People like Brian Holm, Rolf Aldag in the past have known when to be fairly firm with him. And I think he's getting that Omega Pharma.
And Rod Ellingworth.
Correct, yeah.
Let's hear now from Mark, shall we? And then we'll come back, maybe chat about him a bit more with Lionel as well. I mean, have you started thinking about next year yet?
We basically talk through the programme next year with everything, again, based on the Tour de France. Obviously, it's a big thing. The Tour de France has come to England for the second time since I turned professional. To be able to do three stages, pretty special, especially the first stage finishing in Harrogate, my mum's hometown. Roads I know well there.
Yeah.
And another sprint, another opportunity for me to try and pull on the yellow jersey.
But the Giro, are you thinking that you'll miss that? Or?
Well, I don't know. We have to see. There's new people in the team, and we have to see what the goals of the team are for next year.
What about Argentina, Qatar? I mean, do you know where you'll start your season yet?
Not really. There's still some final things coming in. They haven't spoke to everybody in the team yet, but we'll know in the middle of December, really.
And obviously a few little changes next year with Renshaw coming in. And Pataki will still be there as well, won't he?
Absolutely. I think with them two, I've got incredible experience and incredible commitment. I raced with Pataki once this year in the Tour of Britain, and we tried for three sprints. He won three sprints. I could just follow him exactly like I could Renshaw.
Yeah.
And he was so smooth and so relaxed. It was beautiful. It was like following Renshaw again. So I think so with the two of them.
Could you ride with both of them?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I'd like to, I think they complement each other really
potentially
well.
They could both go the tour with you.
Yeah.
Who would perform what role in that?
I don't know. We'll have to see how things go in the year, you know. We'll have to see what the other goals are at the tour and what the other goals are throughout the year for the team. But I know if I have them two with me in a sprint, as well as the other guys, I'd like to get Steenmans, Matteo Trentin, then we've got a formidable lineup in a sprint train.
Again, I mean, you've said again that, you know, like sprinting, that leading out is not something you tend to practice. It tends to be something you just do in race situations. Would that be something you would change at all? Or?
I think, yeah, we will work on it because we have got a structured group now. It's not like beginning this year where we were chopping and changing with different people. We didn't know who would fit where. But next year, at least we know what role people have to play, and we can definitely work on that.
Another new rider, Rigoberto Urán, somebody you didn't have perhaps a great experience with him at the Giro 2012. Does it change anything, or do you think he'll do a different program? Because he's obviously a GC rider.
Programs. I think we've been the most successful team this year in terms of number of wins, and we've just been kind of missing on those GC points. And that was where Rigoberto was brought in. You know, we can do the Hilly Classics in the GC, which we kind of haven't scored the World Tour points in. I think so. Definitely, he's a good guy to do that, and he's got a great support team. I know the climbers in our team are super good. They just needed this leader to work for, and he'll be great on that side, I think.
You know, the chapter in your book on you know, the Armstrong fallout and so on is interesting. But the one thing that caught my eye was your suggestion that you'd be willing to be tagged instead of whereabouts. Yeah. I've never heard an athlete say that before.
Well, because I find the hardest thing is having to do that. Missing it on, like, imagine you get a doping thing because of a administrative error. That's not nice, and that's where it's going to come. If you're not doping, the only way it can come from is that. And if you get missed tests because of an administrative error, you know, it's pretty scary stuff.
And you had a scare at Bernie's wedding, didn't you?
I had to go and do it. Like, I just got to do it. I had to go and
text it. Yeah. We just stood talking. If I wasn't reminded, I wouldn't go and text it, you know. Sometimes you don't know your flights, you can change the days. I think I was going to fly to Bernie's a couple of days before. No, the day off, and then I did it the day before. I mean, it's changing it, you know. It's pretty scary, all that, you know. Mm. Considering we probably get 40 or 50 out of competition tests a year, you know, it's a lot of times to that you have to be correct with it, you know. If you're only getting, like in some sports, you get one a year. It's not even whether you're cheating or not, it's the fact that you can't really mess up on an administrator every time you get tested once a year. If you test that much, the chances of something like that happening is pretty scary. Mm. So I'd rather just that, and then I don't have to think about it.
It's a pretty radical suggestion.
I'd rather that than just have to think.
I can see a lot of athletes refusing to do that, though.
Yeah, but
you'd be willing.
I would.
I spoke to you in January, obviously, at the camp, and you were pretty happy. Does this feel like home, this team, now?
I'm very happy in the team. I've got a lot of friends now built up this year. It's different than last year when I came in, that everyone was real nice, but I kind of felt like I slotted in, but you still didn't have the personal relationships that I've got now, you know. I've been through two grand tours together with some of the guys, and experience of that really draw you together. And I've got a close group in the team now, a team that work together, we hang around together, and we're more than teammates, we're friends now. And that's really nice to feel, and it really bodes well for the future, you know. Mm-hmm. The transitional stage is kind of over in less than a year. It's very positive to see the board thinking of the team and the managers and the riders involved.
Does it feel like HTC, or is it quite different?
It's a bit different to HTC, but in terms of what I want to do in a sport, no, I'm very happy. It's very, very positive step for me to make to come here.
I mean, how long is your contract with them? Are you
another 2 years?
There has been talk of another British team being set up. Would that ever interest you?
The only people I've heard that from is journalists.
Yeah, maybe journalists are behind it. Would you join a journalist team?
No.
You're listening to the Humans Invent Cycling Podcast, powered by Sharp.
That's Mark Cavendish. They're not too positive about the idea that a journalist team that he would perform in any kind of journalist team. Not too much of a surprise.
Would we have to ride, or would we be in the team?
We'd be managing it.
That would be interesting.
Yeah, you'd be mechanic, I think. You'd see you out there by the cars with a sponge and a bucket.
I'm not very good. I can't even really change a tube, you know.
And you'd be putting on those old Delta brakes as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, Mark, what do you think about his next year, big year for him?
I think sort of three things occur, really, with the move to Omega Pharma. First of all, it kind of happened quite late in the day. It didn't get finalised until quite late in the day. And Brian Holm made the point to me not that long ago when I spoke to him, that although he was very confident that Cavendish would leave Sky and join Omega Pharma, there was a lot for the money men and the management to work out, and so the putting together of a team and the gelling of a sprint train didn't really start until they all got together in sort of January time, and there's not a lot of time to put something together, and that it was a learning process. And I think HTC Colombia made that sprint train look ridiculously easy because they'd worked at it, they'd built it up, they had certain types of personalities and riders that really they took it to such a level against, at the time, not a great deal of opposition. I think Brian said that at the time Garmin were the only other team that had half a sprint train, whereas now you've got Lotto Belisol, you've got Argos Shimano, who are dedicated rivals to Omega Pharma. You've got Cannondale trying to do a little bit for Peter Sagan as well. So that's one point. It was a work in progress, and with the addition of Pataki and now Renshaw, they will get better, because Mark Cavendish expects it to be at that level. Having experienced that with HTC, he expects that level again. The other point is that Omega Pharma is a very old school team still, or although it's kind of changing with the way that Aldag and Holm work, bringing in the influence of what they did with HTC Colombia, there's still a kind of old school Belgian mentality that comes from Lefebvre, you know. And the risk is with a rider like Cavendish, who's like your most reliable winner, he can deliver 15, 18, 20 wins a season, and so he races an awful lot. I think he did 96 days in 2013.
He actually admitted in that interview, we didn't play that bit, but he admitted that he perhaps did too much.
Yeah, and he started in Argentina at the Tour de San Luis in January. He won there. He won in Qatar in February. He won Depana. He won a stage of Depana in March, I think. April was when he took his break for the prior to the Giro, so he didn't really race much. That was the only month he didn't win a race. Mm. And it Scheldeprijs, I think, the Belgian one-day race, was another one that kind of signified some of the problems that Amiga Pharma were having. Paris-Roubaix comes up on the Sunday, and Holmes said that all of the Belgians on the team were really had three-quarters of their mind on Sunday's race and not their full focus on giving a lead out to Cavendish. And so Kittel was able to spring, you know, a bit of a surprise perhaps at that time of the season. We wouldn't perhaps have expected Kittel to win against Cavendish in Scheldeprijs. So the signs were there that he, you know, Cavendish, I think, had a very good season, but because the Tour de France dominates everything, and because Kittel won four stages and Cavendish won two, that casts a sort of shadow over the whole of the rest of the season. So I think if Cavendish were to win 19 races again next year, but four of them were Tour stages, the perception would be entirely different compared to how it's been this year.
I mean, I think he may ultimately benefit from Kittel's success last year, because while we say that the sprint train Omega Pharma has been reinforced this year with Renshaw and Pataki, it certainly needs to be better organised than it was in the Tour. It would be to Cavendish's advantage if Kittel comes in with a huge sprint train, because Lefebvre has done what he's done several times in the past, and he's fallen back into the trap of trying to hedge his bets in the Tour de France this year. He's going to go in with Uran as well.
I think there's a high likelihood
that he will go in with Uran as well, unless you know, there's too much opposition from Cavendish. And you know, it will be a divided team. There will be Uran, if he is going for general classification, he'll have at least one, two support riders. Boonen is desperate to ride because of the stage over cobbles. It seemed as though he was never going to ride again. So Cavendish might go in a bit light on manpower, and he will need other teams. He will need Greipel's sprint team to be strong, and he will need Kittel's to be strong as well.
The difficulty for Cavendish is that he has set the bar. I think we said on the podcast before, you know, probably perhaps don't appreciate how good he is now while we're in the thick of his career. And really, it will be once he's gone and when we see that riders don't win the way he has won. I mean, you know, even just winning the points competitions in the Vuelta, the Giro and the Tour over the course of, you know, not even over the course of his whole career yet. You know, that's something only four other people have done. And I think it's so easy to look at a season and through just the prism of the Tour de France.
He gets very frustrated by this, and he got pretty frustrated by that when I asked him about it.
Yeah, particularly when you look at the Giro and how brutal it was in terms of the, what was the mountain on the penultimate day, Tre Cime de Lavaredo.
Yeah.
And the fact that he was trailing Nibali in the points, he had to get over that inside the time limit in terrible weather, a snowstorm. And then the stage into Brescia, okay, likelihood is he's going to win the stage or be high enough up there to take the points competition, but he still had to ride through 3 weeks of miserable conditions.
And from the Giro, he went to Glasgow and rode a very tough race there, a pretty grueling national road race, which he had to race in a completely different way. And I think that took a lot out of him. It took a lot out of him, and he had to hang around afterwards in the cold and so on. And that could be why he had turned up at the Tour.
He was on antibiotics going into the Tour, wasn't he? I think Rob Hales said he woke up on the Tuesday after, not Rob Hales woke up, Cavendish woke up the Tuesday after the National Championships, the day before he's supposed to travel to the Tour, feeling just not right, like he was coming down with something. So, and talking to Brian Holm about the 2 days that stand out for him from the season, one is that National Championship where Cavendish and Andy Fenn were the only two Amiga riders going in against Sky with how many, half a dozen, maybe more, that by rights, statistically, by rights, they had no right to win that race with just two men. And the other one, which we talked a lot about, was the stage in the crosswind in the Tour, where, and Holm says that's the day that stands out for him as the most memorable of his career as a director sportif. So, Cavendish delivered some massive moments.
He did. You can't have it both ways, though. I mean, he's the one who always talks about the Tour being the biggest race in the world. And, you know, winning on the Champs-Élysées has been a huge thing for him the last few years. Was it 3 years in a row he won on the Champs-Élysées? 4 years in a row he won on the Champs-Élysées. So that is the stage for the sprinters. I mean, we should also pay respect to Kittel. For him, such a big guy, to haul himself over the mountains in the way he did on a pretty tough tour this year, pretty mountainous tour. He had a very disappointing debut the year before at the tour, didn't make it past the first week, I don't think. And I think there was always a fear with him that he was going to be this kind of playboy, not playboy, but he's a good-looking bloke. He's a big, powerful sprinter in the mould, physically at least, of a Mario Cipollini. And would he be the sort of sprinter who might dazzle in the first week and then disappear as soon as the race hits the mountain? So I think for him, still young as well, to finish the tour, to win four stages, get through those mountain stages, win on Champs-Élysées, you know, he's also going into the winter buoyed.
Just back on Cavendish and Lefebvre, Lefebvre being the kind of the old school manager who doesn't get in on the ground and direct tactics or anything like that, but he is the boss of the team. And
deepest voice in cycling.
On the after that stage on the Champs-Élysées where Cavendish had been beaten, I was waiting outside their bus for just to see what the reaction was when Cavendish came back, and Lefebvre was there, dressed like a sort of a mafia boss who's retired to Florida, in a pink jacket and white trousers, or it might have been a white jacket and pink trousers. I can't remember which way round it was. It was
the reincarnation of Guimard.
It was an extraordinary outfit, and everyone around the bus has got a little glass of champagne, and they're all toasting what for Amiga Pharma was a very successful tour, with wins for Tony Martin, Trentin. Cavendish, of course, and the young Italian Trentin. Yeah. So, but it struck me that Lefebvre there didn't really understand the character of his chief asset there, because his team has had some absolutely dog-awful tours when Boonen's been misfiring and everything's gone wrong for them. But it struck me as incongruous to see them all celebrating with champagne, and Cavendish came back to the bus and he wasn't as angry as we've seen him in the past. There was no, he didn't throw his bike down or throw his helmet out of the bus as he has done in the past, but it made me think, this team isn't necessarily from the top completely set up around one of the fastest men in the world.
I mean, there is this, there's definitely been an incompatibility of the mentalities there, in the sense that Cavendish has realised to what extent the classics really dominate the agenda there, and he still can't fathom why, if you look at their roster of 25 or 28 riders, however many it is, there might be 8, 9, 10 classic specialists. Now, Cavendish says that in the first 150 kilometres of the Tour of Flanders, it's pointless having a guy who thrives in the classics but is pretty much useless for the rest of the year. You only need a pretty basic, bog-standard ruler, because anyone can do that. Mark says he could do that job. Yet, the roster is absolutely clogged up with young Belgians who only dream of one day winning GP Harald Becker or Gent-Wevelgem. And Mark thinks that, you know, it's just pretty much a waste of resources. And I know there have been discussions about this winter, this autumn, but it remains to be seen how much they've taken on board, because he feels that, you know, they are slightly one-dimensional.
Perhaps it's a thing of the past to imagine a team built around one rider in these days of 30-man teams and multiple programs and all the rest of it. But, you know, if you're going to build your team around any one rider who's going to bring you a lot of wins, it would be Mark Cavendish. And it's, you know, you've got Cannondale, which is a team now that's really built around Peter Sagan. And here he is again in a team where they do, and especially with the hiring of Uran, they are, as you say, hedging their bets, spreading their butter quite thin.
I mean, I think this is where we talked about Bob Stapleton earlier, Rolf Haldo, Brian Hunt. I think this is where that team didn't really get enough credit, and they were quite visionary in the sense that they really did stack all of their resources behind races.
Which was a frustration at times for like Michael Rogers, for example. I remember, was it 2009 or 2010, he was in great sort of form, stage racing form on Tour California, and he wanted to go into the Tour with just the ambition of finishing in the top six or something, top ten, and he was really denied that opportunity. Mm. He had to sacrifice his chances to help Cavendish, and that takes kind of strong leadership to do that.
Yeah, but Bob Stapleton, he specifically identified a gap in the market, didn't he? Where if you can win a lot of races, they didn't have the firepower to maybe win enough of the big races, so they thought, let's go for bulk, let's win a lot of races. And I think in terms of the evolution of how teams are being put together and selected, there's so many, there's such a difference between the ones that are the best and the ones that are the weakest. And I don't know whether you know this, the answer to this, Daniel, but I mean, 2 weeks ago, Sky had their big meeting where they pretty much decide the season for every single rider. So if you went and asked a Sky rider what they're doing next year, they will know whether their focus is the classics and the Vuelta or the...
Yeah, I think every team's the same in that sense.
Do you get that feeling, or do you get the feeling sometimes with a team like Amiga Pharma that everything's kind of up for grabs a lot more, even going into sort of key periods of the season? I don't know.
I spoke to Bobby Julich yesterday, who was talking about, he's at BMC now, and you know, he was talking about the difference between when he went from Sky, as he was forced to do last year, to BMC, just what an incredible change there was in terms of organisation. And that's one of the best funded teams in the world. I think we kind of knew that about BMC, but I think they're getting their act together.
Yeah,
now.
They are. I think under Alan Piper.
Under Alan Piper, yeah.
But it's interesting, isn't it? A lot of the personnel that are kind of coming out into other teams, and, you know, Amiga Pharma, Aldag and Holm, they're from HTC, you know, Alan Piper also. The problem with Amiga Pharma, it's been suggested to me, is that Aldag and Holm don't quite have enough of a say that they had at
HTC. Still the Wilfred Peters, Lefebvre,
yeah,
Belgian.
Because Bob Stapleton was very much the outsider coming in and saying to these guys, right, you tell me, you know, what should we be doing? Whereas Lefebvre and Peters perhaps are harder to persuade that actually this might be a more efficient way to go about it.
Yeah, and they are, I think one of the problems with Amiga Pharma Quickstep is they are so... They're so Belgian-centric, and on one level it's understandable, because you have to be in Belgium, you have to go to Belgium during the classic season to see what huge amount of coverage is available to those teams. You know, it's 6 pages a day in every single paper, it's blanket coverage on television, so it's understandable that they will, you know, stack all of their resources almost behind that period of the season. On the other hand, Quickstep's biggest market now is the UK. Omega Pharma also are selling a lot of products in the UK and other markets internationally. So I think there is a bit of a disconnect between perhaps what's best for the sponsor and what in Lefebvre and Peters and all the other Belgian kind of managers, what in their minds has always constituted the kind of be-all and end-all.
The Cycling Podcast with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
Okay, competition time. Still nobody has got the mystery voice. It's not Fabian Cancellara, it's not Andreas Klier, it's not Kurt Hazard-Arvidsson, it's not Bernie Eisel, Johan Bruneel, Michele Ferrari, Hein Verbruggen. I think there's a bit of a theme there. I think people were a bit misled by the bad Santa clue. It's not Brian Holm, it's not Andreas Klöden, it's not Rolf Aldag, it's not Rolf Sørensen, and it's not Johnny Welts, and it's not Mauro Santambrogio. Clever answer. I think people... Bad Santa.
It's not Billy Bob Thornton either. Is that who played Bad Santa?
So that's still our clue. The other clue is it's not a rider. Never has been a rider, has he? Well, not a professional rider anyway.
No, I don't think so. I'm
pretty sure he's not been any kind of rider. So that's the clue. Here's the mystery voice.
You should not become the fool of the media. Should not become the fool of a liar like him. And this is a disappointing for me from the media.
So that was the mystery voice. Please enter by tweeting at HumansInvent, hashtag mystery voice. Do we want to add anything more to the pile of prizes? We've got Sky's the Limit, Inside Team Sky, Volume 3 of the Cycling Anthology.
Not having my jumper, if that's what you're thinking, Rich.
Your jumper?
No.
Anything else to add to the pile? Maybe a copy of Hunger by Sean Kelly? I'll tell you what, we'll offer a copy of At Speed, the Mark Cavendish book.
Will we?
Yeah, we'll get a copy of that, because that interview was to publicise the autobiography, which is very good.
How are we going to get a copy of that?
Which I can recommend.
We'll get a copy of that
from the publishers, okay. Daniel. I'm sure you've got some contacts.
No, I haven't,
there.
Actually.
Anyway, let's hear it again. Here's the mystery voice.
You should not become the fool of... the media should not become the fool of a liar like him. And this is a disappointing for me from the media.
Well, that was the mystery voice. Enter at HumansInvent, hashtag mystery voice, for a copy of Sky's the Limit, Inside Team Sky, Cycling Anthology Volume 3, and Mark Cavendish at Speed. That's a lot of reading, isn't it?
Hell of a prize, that.
That'll take you through 2014, I would have thought.
It's like Saturday Superstore when the prize was just like...
massive.
Yeah.
And this could go on forever.
Good.
Forever.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. For more articles, go to humansinvent.com/cycling.
Any other business? We were going to mention briefly a couple of stories that were in the news this week. We should also mention briefly that we've got very good news on the podcast, that we can confirm that this podcast will continue in weekly form next year and in daily form at the Tour de France. We can confirm that. We've just had lunch with our sponsor, who assured us that our futures are secure.
So it's only a rolling one-year contract now, isn't it?
Any other business? Well, one story that caught my eye the other day was the Women's Tour of Britain is struggling for a title sponsor. I don't think this threatens the event, but it's quite a surprise, isn't it, when you consider the profile of cycling in the UK at the moment, the profile of some of the women cyclists who will be riding, like Laura Trott, who is a major sporting star here. Odd that I don't know what they're asking for, obviously, but you have to look at the Sky sponsorship again.
And, what do you think they're asking for? What's going right, would you say?
I have no idea. Lionel, have you got any idea?
No.
But I presume they would have asked Sky. Now, Sky don't sponsor women's team, which is fairly controversial. Have they asked Sky, and Sky have said no? It's given their remit, given that they're... The focus is not just some men's professional road cycling. It is a strange one, their apparent reluctance to get involved in supporting women's cycling.
Well, the thing is, if indeed I have approached Sky, the problem is, from a purely business point of view, they would say, well, we've already got a stake in the British women's team. You know, they've already got Laura Trott riding around in Sky-branded British kit. One of the big sort of hidden sort of controversies, if you like, is that the words Great Britain don't even feature on the Great Britain kit. It says British Cycling, and it says Sky, and it says, I think, maybe Gatorade. I can't remember from the last time I saw it. But so Sky's branding, it already runs to the core of that very successful women's team. So when you've got the world record-breaking Team Pursuit squad, or you've got Becky James, or you've got Laura Trott riding in an individual event, Sky's branding is already completely associated. So what else would they get out of sponsoring the women's tour? And from a sort of cold-hearted business point of view, they may feel that there isn't a great deal more to add.
What is the Women's Tour of Britain offering in terms of guaranteed TV coverage?
I think there is a package put together, isn't there?
Has a huge influence.
Yeah, and it's a brand new event, and in order to pin your corporation or company's name to a brand new event, it's quite a leap, isn't it? Particularly if you're talking hundreds of thousands of pounds. We're hearing everywhere, aren't we, that sponsorship is not easy to come by in any sport. I mean, you have to look at a massive sport like football to see that the growth area is really only online gambling in recent years, in terms of shirt sponsorship in football. Disproportionately so, the amount of online gambling that is visible at Premier League and lower division football. So who is it out there really that is spending money on sports sponsorship? I can't think of a sort of glut of cash out there.
Well, I'm just doing my research here, and Guy Elliott, who's behind the Women's Tour on behalf of the Sweet Spot, who organised the Men's Tour of Britain, has said recently that we've been in discussion with TV and we're confident of having extensive coverage. We don't want to say which station, but we believe that it will be a game changer because we'll have daily significant TV coverage. So they seem confident they will have TV coverage. Perhaps that will be the key to unlock the sponsorship. But it's odd that this sponsorship story came out at this stage, because it doesn't, it doesn't do the event any favours, I wouldn't have thought.
Well, it could be a bargaining chip as well, couldn't it? A way to get a story in the papers to drum up some interest.
It's not very good for a potential sponsor, though, is it, to come in now,
knowing that they're desperate?
Yeah, I mean, there is a sort of air of desperation around it.
I think in terms of broadcast rights as well, one of the biggest players, BT Sport, is still only offering a relatively restricted market. So you could end up sponsoring something, and then if it ends up on BT Sport, which not everybody has, I know the Revolution series is now on BT Sport, and people who previously had ITV4 and were able to watch that for free very easily without having to subscribe to a new service have now kind of lost that bit of cycling because it's gone to BT Sport, I gather. So again, if TV is the kingpin and they haven't got that in place yet, that does make it harder.
Any other business, fellas? You mentioned Richie Port earlier, Daniel.
Yeah, just slightly surprised that it has made news. A, that Green Edge are keen to sign him. I think that's been well known for at least a year now.
This is 2015. 2016. We're talking about.
Yeah, because he renewed his contract this year, didn't he? Yeah. And also that, you know, that there is talk that he wants to leave Sky at the end of that contract. It's very early in the day. An awful lot can happen. You know, he could go from his current status of, you know, one of the 5 or 10 most promising Grand Tour riders to, you know, almost nowhere in this. We've seen that many times before. I think he does have potential to contend for major tours. We'll see. We'll be able to gauge it better after the Giro this year, which is probably the first Grand Tour that he's gone into with realistic hopes of a podium finish or perhaps a win. I mean, personally, I think, you know, if you look back over the history of cycling, it's littered with examples of domestiques de luxe who have thought and have been told that they could go into another team, into a different environment, ride for themselves and reproduce and improve on the performances that they've been showing as leaders and have not always done that. I mean, various people have talked about this in the past. I remember an Italian rider, Marzio Brizeghin, who really made that step from domestique to team leader and then went to another team, signed a bigger contract, and was given the role of team leader. And he just said that it's completely different. You know, riding to, being told that you have to ride to 2 kilometres from the top of a mountain pass and then pull off is completely different to riding to the top and having to concentrate over the other side and, you know, stay at the front on a descent. And it's a totally different mindset. And you're not always able to make that.
And Mark Renshaw would probably say it's a totally different prospect being asked to ride to 200 metres to
exactly.
go. You know, it's the same similar scenario where he left. It's a bit like the lead guitarist going solo, you know, and trying to become a winner in his own right, and it hasn't worked out for him at Rabobank and Belkin. He's been back to a support role. You know, and there's a lot to be said for the support role. I mean, I think we've seen far more out of Nicholas Roach this year, and he's been primarily in a support role.
Yeah.
He's ridden better than as a leader.
And if you take the example of Richie Port, if a team had gone in this year with Richie Port as the leader, they would have been delirious on the evening of Axe Trois des Mennes, and they would have been all of their plans would have been ruined by the next evening because Richie Port had a disastrous second day in the Pyrenees.
He had a disastrous second day because he was covering for Peter Kenyuk and trying to chase everything early on the next day, which he wouldn't have been doing had he been a leader.
Possibly.
You could argue.
Possibly.
I have to say, team transfer speculation leaves me a bit cold.
Especially when we're talking about 2016.
Exactly.
I don't even know if there'll be a sport in 2016.
Well, I mean, the big problem is that the riders are a team that's trying to put together a squad now with more riders on, so particularly with the big squad, Sky, Amiga Pharma, Green Edge, probably one or two others. They're the only ones that have the luxury to have this kind of forward planning. You know, there's a lot of teams. I mean, 2 years ago, Rabobank, you would have included them as well. But now, with the Belkin sponsorship not offering the same level of security, but I do find, I know the fans get very excited about the idea of riders moving teams and whether this is going to really impact on the, you know, this rider or that rider or this team. But really what happens is that everybody starts racing again in January or February and it all settles down and it's as if, you know, we very quickly get used to people in different kits. And Richie Port,
the novelty lasts for a couple of laps of that criterium in Adelaide.
It does, yeah. And Richie Port will or won't evolve into a Grand Tour contender. I know that's a
thanks for that. Great analysis.
But what I'm saying is, for more of that analysis,
stay tuned.
What I'm saying is, he will or won't, whether he's with Sky or with Orica Green Edge in future. It's whether his legs are able to make him into a Grand Tour, and that sounds
Brilliant.
You've taken the mickey there, but it's a great note
to end on, Lionel. We don't know if the sport will still be around in 2016, but I'm pretty sure this podcast will be. Don't know what we'll be talking about, mind you.
It might be, it might not.
I'm sure it will be.
Based on today's lunch discussion, I think we're probably good to go.
Excellent. Right, well, we're going to come back next week for one final podcast for 2013. It's going to be a retirement special podcast. Daniel came up with this idea, so it's all his responsibility. He's got to organise it in the next week. But you went through the list of, can you rattle through some of the names of writers? It's the real end of an era.
A couple of my favourite, Menshov and Clodin.
Menshov, Clodin.
Pinotti, Kazar.
Van der Velde. Fletcher.
Fletcher. I mean, it really is
there's
a kind
huge
of watershed.
Number of top writers.
Yeah, and it is a lot of the sort of emblematic, perhaps not the most well-known writers of that generation, but it's a lot of real mainstays of what has probably been pejoratively referred to as the EPO generation, or the kind of last throes of the EPO generation.
With a couple in there who certainly stood apart from that crowd, it should be said. I think you're going to try and fix up a couple of interviews with those guys,
one,
Daniel.
Rich, I did promise one.
One or two. I think you delivered a minimum of one with an expectation of two. So we'll look forward to that. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
The Humans Invent Cycling Podcast. Interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.